From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. General Motors is shutting down production at 5 plants across North America this year, leaving thousands of workers without jobs. These real-world events are mirrored in the Atlanta production of Skeleton Crew. It's a story of a tight-knit group of workers at the only auto-stamping plant left in Detroit. And it takes place during the 2008 recession, when workers are dealing with layoffs and an uncertain future.
What is life at a copy center? Day in, day out, running paper through these simple machines. For what? It ain't got the same kind of pride this work got. Here, I'm building something important.
Skeleton Crew runs now through March 10th at Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater Company. And Jamil Jude is joining us in the studio. He's director and the new artistic director for the theater. Jamil, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Can you give us a little bit of a summary of the play, like what kind of things these characters are grappling with?
Well, we have these four characters who are facing the impending closing. We have Reggie, who's a middle manager, sworn to secrecy by management. He has to protect the interests of the company, but wants to also protect the interests of his employees, people he's been working with on the line, because he's grown up through the ranks for about a decade. One of those women are Faye. Faye has been working at the company for 29 years, and if she could just make it to 30 years, that retirement package would look so much better. Also, Dez, a young man who has a track towards his dreams and just needs a little bit more overtime to get there, and he's finally joined with a woman named Shanita, who's pregnant in the clip that you just played. Shanita talks about how much pride she has. She's a second-generation factory worker, and this is the work that she loves to do. But an impending closing could put her future and her child's future in jeopardy. So this play really grapples with those real life circumstances when we hear those big headlines of plant closing and government shutdowns. We often think about policy, but we often forget about the people, the real people whose lives are going to be affected by not receiving a check or having to be forced into retirement or closing of a lifestyle. So I'm really excited by getting an opportunity to really explore these deep themes that people are dealing with on a daily basis.
And this is a multi-generational, multi-layered in the hierarchy group of people. And it's so much about their identity as auto workers. What did that mean, especially for the African-American characters in the play?
Well, I mean, all the characters are African-American. And what it really says is that the value of hard work. You know, I think there has been a legacy of Black people in depiction of work and what work ethic really means. But for these Detroiters, their pride is found in what they do, their ability to create something with their hands, especially for these people in this auto facility. That's their pride and joy. So to strip somebody of the thing that they do, of the thing that gives them pride, of the thing that brings them a livelihood, really is stripping people from what we want to believe as Americans is a fundamental right, a right to work, a right to make a living, a right to do the things that we want to do. And when you strip people of that, what's left? The soul. And if you tamper with it, or if you make it harder for people to achieve the American dream, you're really starting to take their soul away from them as well.
And this play, Skeleton Crew, it's part of playwright Dominique Morisseau's Detroit cycle. You know, she does a trilogy, a series of three plays set in the city. So how about the identity of Detroit? How does it help us understand that?
Well, you know, Dominique loves her city. I think she thinks of each play as a little bit of a love song to the city. And what the cycle allows us to do, I think when we think Detroit, two things probably come to mind. One, we think about the love and the glory of Motown, right? We think of the sound. We think of that Motown sound. And I think here in contemporary times, we think about the destruction and degradation of the city. I think we think of what happened to Detroit post-2008. And I think what Dominique has tried to do is she's trying to give us a wider entree into the city. She really wants to show us the city at different times in its life. Paradise Blue is set in the 1940s, and that's the first play. Detroit 67, that True Colors presented back in 2015, talks about the height of it, but also when the city was literally on fire,
right, burning,
because of the race riots. And here we have another pivotal moment, another revolutionary moment here in 2008. What she really wants to do is say, yes, all of these headlines are about the city, but really, let's just focus on the people who are there, who were there, who are still there. And I'm excited. I don't think she's done. I think she's going to come out with another play that's going to give us a larger insight into 2020 and 2021 Detroit, so we can really get this picture, this real panoramic picture of what it means to be Detroit, because I think so many of us as Americans misunderstand that city.
Yeah, it has a huge emotional sense, or let's say reputation, you know, as the heart, this engine that churned out American cars. So in these conversations that you had with the actors playing Dez, Shanita, Faye, and Reggie, what kind of conversations did you have with them about taking on these identities?
Well, one thing that we wanted to do, we always are trying to find authenticity as actors and as artists in the room. We always search for what we call the capital T truth. What's that universal truth about these characters that we can tap into as performers in Atlanta, although we aren't from Detroit? But what are the things? Love, pride, respect for self, respect for work. But we also wanted to make sure that we brought in, because this play is so Detroit specific, we wanted to bring in people and have in around the creative process Detroiters. So our assistant director, Danye Brown, is a born and raised West Sider from Detroit. She's an amazing artist, and she's been able to help us with some of the nuances of the people, so we can really bring that truth and authenticity. And I believe that it's shining through. And when your listeners come and check out the show, especially those from the D, they'll have to let me know if we've
found it right.
If we got it right. And I think that's the essence. That's the soil of the people. People who have grit and determination. Faye has a monologue about growing up on the east side of Detroit and seeing houses burn down on Devil's Night in 1967 and being confronted with this idea of, will you wither away or will you stand tall? So we talk a lot about, what does it mean for all of these characters in the face of oppression, in the face of a crisis? How do they choose to stand tall, stand with one another? But also there are moments of opposition, and how do you stand against one another in the moment of a crisis?
That's Jamil Jude. He's the director of Skeleton Crew. It's open now and at Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater. So this decision that they're faced with, you know, how to stand tall, as you said, but there's also a central question there. What would you sacrifice to survive in some way? So what did you ask yourself and them while putting together the production?
Well, you know, I think I happened to be working on a play about Gordon Parks right before I went to
the photographer, Gordon Parks.
The photographer and activist and film director and music composer and writer. He wrote so many autobiographies about his life. But one of the things in working on that play, we talked about artistic sacrifice. And I think that's also something that's been really huge for us in this room as we talk about, well, what does it mean to be an artist, to sacrifice our time? I can't tell you how many hours I've spent in a dark theater watching people play make-believe, right? But also, what does that mean for our families? Are we able to be there as present as we want to for our families? So in the context of this room, people are putting their bodies on the line. Several of the characters are scarred up, either because of incidents at the facility or things that have happened in their lives. People are working long hours. They're tired. What happens to your feet and your body as you've been working these things? So what are you willing to sacrifice just for a sense of pride? Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? What do you have to sacrifice for those that you love? What I love about building ensemble are those conversations that you get to have. Not only are we putting on this play, but we're creating a family inside the rehearsal hall. So what can we sacrifice for one another as we learn lines or as we make a mistake? How do we support and lift each other up? When you get an opportunity to work on a show with people grappling these things, it makes you value the work of the everyday person in ways in which I feel like we sometimes get detached. We are so me, 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 and what do I have to give up? We forget about what the other person has to give up to be in the room with us. And this play has really taught me more to think broadly about other people's sacrifices as well.
Mm-hmm. And this is, especially when you say blue-collar workers, this is this big swath of human beings without looking at the individuals necessarily. And the production actually deals with the play. Inside the play is collective bargaining, the fear of losing one's livelihood. And we saw unions stepping forward to advocate for workers during the recent government shutdown. Skeleton Crew, of course, written long before that. But do you think it speaks to current events through that parallel?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my uncle was affected by the government shutdown. He works at TSA. He's one of the managers at TSA. And to think about what he had to give up in order to go to work just so that we could travel safely. And those are the things that, again, I feel like while working on the show, I've been reminded in a really sincere way that in order for us to have our conveniences, there are several people who have to get to work so much earlier than us, who are leaving their kids early in the morning, who are taking the bus maybe, who are driving themselves, who are working a 12-hour shift only to go home and sleep for a few hours just to work another shift. We forget about those people, and this play reminds us not to. This play reminds us the power of advocacy. This play reminds us why unionization was so important, why the UAW was so strong, why the UAW was so integral to Detroit becoming the city that drove the country. I don't want to ever forget how important the labor union has been in building this country, and I don't want to forget on whose backs our country was built on. And especially as we move forward, I think we get further and further away from the truth of that. And any opportunity that we get to be reminded of who is sacrificing themselves in order for the greater good. Oftentimes that's women, oftentimes that's women of color. And this play helps that. Dominique Mauriceau does a really good job of putting these stories in front of us in a way that it is not didactic, it is not confrontational, it is real, it is honest, and that's the best type of theater.
Mm. And your own work, how about that? You are recently the new artistic director of the theater, taking over for Kenny Leon. It's a big mantle to take on. How did he prepare you to take on this role?
What Kenny's always done a really good job of, and he may not admit to it, is that he's done a really good job of being a mentor. Kenny shies away at it and says, you know, it's too much responsibility to be somebody's mentor. But what he does is he makes himself available. I met Kenny back in 2008, 2009. And at that time, I was an intern and I was tasked with following him around. And he was gruff. If you ever met Kenny, he can be gruff a little bit, too. And I mentioned that I was from Tallahassee, Florida, and his smile opened up.
Kenny he's from Florida, isn't he?
He's from Tallahassee. Yeah. He was born in Tallahassee and raised in southern Florida. And that changed. And I started talking to him because at that time I had not met a professional black male director in my life. So I talked to him about the things that I was interested in. At that time, I fashioned myself more as a playwright, but I had a deep interest in telling story. And he gave me his number and he said, hey, you know, I don't really know about being a mentor because I asked him. He said, but here's my number. Use it. And to his credit, every time I called, every time I text, he would respond back. Even when I forgot to call or text, he would shoot me a text and say, hey, just checking in on you. And I think that's the way he's prepared me. He's taught me that no matter where you go, you have to be your authentic self. And when you're there, share your light with as many people as possible. I've tried to do that and inviting as many people into the rehearsal hall just to watch and observe. So I'm really excited that Kenny's been able to just bless me in that way.
Well, Jamil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jamil Jude, he is the director of Skeleton Crew, and the production is open now at Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater and runs through March 10th. We're going to keep the drama going today. Up next, Spelman College presents a new adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, set in modern-day Atlanta. That's when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Director Baz Luhrmann set Romeo and Juliet in Miami Beach. Jet Li and Alaya played the tragic couple in contemporary China. The warring families of Verona became rival gangs in West Side Story. Shakespeare's play of teenage love has worked prisons, senior centers, and a zombie apocalypse into its plot. Now the backdrop is Atlanta.
Welcome, gentlemen!
R plus J is a hip-hop adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, and junior Alexis Kalani Woodward directs the play. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Happy to have you with us. Booker Vance plays Mercutio. Hello, Booker.
How are you doing?
Very well. Glad to have you both with us. Did you, many of us, saw those movies or had to read Romeo and Juliet in high school? Did you?
Absolutely.
Yep.
I read it when I was in high school, my sophomore year, I believe. And, of course, you know, seen West Side Story. I've seen the Baz Luhrmann version when I was younger. But that was pretty much my exposure to R&J up until this year.
Whoa. So this was like a crash course. How about for you, Booker?
Yeah, I actually read it in eighth grade and didn't like it.
Yeah.
Didn't understand it. You know, it was like a language barrier. And I think I didn't really get it till like junior year of high school when I did this summer program, Chicago U Shakespeare, and they really explained everything to me. They broke down the text, they broke down the language, and they kind of showed me that it wasn't so different from us, like our language. So, yeah.
So in this play, do you use Shakespeare's text or do you use modern English?
Absolutely. We use Shakespeare's classical text and then just transplant it all into our here and now.
All right. So tell me about the here and now. We mentioned some of the adaptations. How did you transplant it, this Renaissance era play in Italy, to contemporary Atlanta?
Well, I originally got the idea over the summer in July. Booker and I both were actually at a program in Oxford called Midsummer in Oxford. It was created by the British American Drama Academy, short BADA, and it was a four-week-long intensive conservatory-like classical theater program. While we were there, we saw a lot of modern adaptions of classical work. So we saw a version of Othello. We actually saw a version of R&J at the RSC. I watched The Duchess of Malfi at the RSC. And it was the first time that I felt like I actually emotionally connected to Shakespeare. You know, I got intellectually, I understood it. And I got what was happening. But I never really felt the way that other people felt about Shakespeare's work until I was there. Mm. And I was able to see how the story can be manipulated in any way to apply to any group of people. And so while I was there, I kind of started meditating on what a hip-hop version of Romeo and Juliet would look like. You know, what would this story look like if I just put it on people who I see when I walk outside every morning? And so I started thinking just about, you know, setting things that are relevant to us, you know, in our time. You know, what about our community that, you know, divides us, you know? And so I started thinking about classism, colorism, you know, those kind of things that don't necessarily have to be about, you know, just being from the wrong side of the street. And so we, in our version, use classism to divide the two segments of people.
Mm-hmm. So there's traditionally the Capulets and the Montagues, these
right.
two warring families. How do you separate them? You know, we have the Jets and the Sharks, if I'm trying to remember, in West Side Story. Mm-hmm. How do you distinguish them?
So the Capulets are what we imagine to be like the black bourgeois, you know, so they're high class, elitist, whereas the Montagues are more what you would call, quote unquote, down to earth, working class citizens, middle class. And so there's also a kind of color scheme thing working here, too. So everyone is based pretty much in all black or black and white. And the Capulets have blue accents as well as silver accents. The Montagues have red and gold. And so visually, we're working with costumes that represent more high class, low class, and you've got different color schemes that go along with that as well.
Yeah, well, you, Booker, are playing Mercutio, who is one of the few who can travel in both of those worlds. Tell us a little bit about this character.
So it was like a lot of discovery with it. Mercutio, like growing up, that was one of my dream roles. And so like this has really like been an honor to kind of take on his role.
Why was it a dream role?
Because I think, you know, and Shakespeare said this himself, he was one of the most extraordinary characters to the point that he basically had to kill him off in order to continue the plot, because otherwise he would have killed Shakespeare, you know? So, like, finding that kind of middle ground where he has a family, he's with the House of Aeschylus, but he chooses not to be with his remaining family members. So, in this case, the prince. And he decides to hang with the Montagues because they're more down to earth. They're more kind of like, you know, gritty and street. And that's what he feels is kind of his tribe. And so he kind of makes fun of people who are vain and materialistic and who kind of are the bourgeoisie, because he feels like, you know, why do you place value on things? But he also, like, kind of makes fun of his friends too, but trying to use humor and puns to get them to realize truths about themselves, because I think he's one of the most, like, wise of the youth characters, but he kind of masks it with his humor and with, like, all the antics.
Hmm. Well, here's a bit of one of Mercutio's famous lines. This is from the 1968 film adaptation by the Italian director Franco Zeffirelli.
A plague on both your houses!
Too much wine!
They've made worms meat of me. I have it. And certainly, too. Your houses.
Yes.
Mercutio.
That is Mercutio, the role that Booker Vance plays in R&J. There's a new adaptation of Shakespeare going on this weekend at Spelman. Alexis Woodard is director of R&J, and she's with us as well. Mercutio also kicks off a very important plot point, a murder that basically banishes Romeo. This is where it all begins and where it all jumps off. He's witty, as you said, a lot of puns, but he's also a hothead. Do you share any personality traits?
I try and limit the hotheadedness. I'm a little more laid back and reserved. It took a lot to get to that point, like in the play, but I did a lot of research, and I watched like a lot of like street movies, like Mean Streets, and I looked at like Johnny Boy, or like Juice, and I looked at Bishop. A lot of that, but also like real life, like people kind of like in the streets just observing behavior and how people kind of carry their weight and how they walk through the streets, how they kind of are with their friends, how they are like separately high schoolers, you know, how that is, because everybody's trying to put up a certain image for people. And so that was a big thing for me. I think I am a little witty, but yeah, not as much of a hothead.
Alexis, did you encourage the actors in this production to do as Booker did, that finding out how to play that character in different kinds of ways?
Oh, absolutely. I think that part of the reason why I wanted to do this show in the way that I did it is because I find that in the Black community, there's a barrier between us and Shakespeare that I experienced and that I had to kind of break through, because, you know, it's that kind of unspoken question of who has ownership of Shakespeare, you know, who does he belong to? And I had to come to the realization that he belongs to all of us. You know, it's just story that we can twist and turn in any way we want. And so in doing this show, I wanted them to find these people in their own lives. You know, we all know a Mercutio. We all know a nurse. We all know a Juliet. We all know a Benvolio. So I need you to find these people in your own community. Watch them. Observe them. You know, how do they act? Because we're not trying to do it, you know, like Baz Luhrmann, or we're not trying to do it like, you know, they did it on Broadway or in, you know, an Italian movie. We're doing our version of it. You know, this is our life. And so in order for this to work, we've got to put ourselves on the stage. So I definitely encourage them to do that. You know, I know Booker uses music a lot in his process. So through creating playlists that you think your character would listen to using modern day music, or observing people, doing research with movies. So absolutely.
So we haven't even gotten to the music part of this. It's a hip hop version. Are the songs, are you using songs from the radio, or is it all original composition?
It is all original composition created by my dear friend and incredible talent, Lorenzo Moore. He is a recent Morehouse alum. He graduated just last year. He's a producer. He goes by The Renaissance, by his artist name.
Appropriate for the play.
Absolutely. He does his own music. Absolutely incredible writer and producer. And he did all the music for the show. He's a sound designer.
So had you ever performed hip hop before, Booker?
Not necessarily, but I'm a big fan.
Mm-hmm. So what was that like? And is it also, it's movement as well.
It is.
So how do you put that all together?
So for me, I was kind of concerned at first, because I heard it was going to be a lot of choreography, and I didn't know if it was like just straight musical, like how the dancing and hip hop kind of infused into it. But I think the way that it's used is for entrances, exits, and we have a house party scene as opposed to, you know, kind of like the ball scene, mm-hmm. where the two lovers meet. And so that's like one of my favorites, because you kind of get to let loose and just like, you know, dance and then add all the contemporary elements into it, the contemporary dances, so then the audience can recognize it and then kind of like get hyped with you. Yeah.
So that's one change. But Romeo and Juliet, this is a story that ends in tragedy when these two lovers, teenagers from rival families, fall madly in love and both die pretty much because of bad communication, if you want the truth. But Alexis, your play starts with their deaths. Why decide to begin there and roll backwards?
It does. Well, just how we were talking about earlier, how this show is done so many times in so many different ways. I feel that often when I've watched the show and when I've been exposed to it, I found myself, you know, tuning out and not really caring about the other characters and just, you know, trying to get to the death or trying to get to the balcony scene, you know, or the party, you know, those big infamous scenes. And for me, when I really delved into the show, that wasn't what it was about. You know, it was about the relationships between the families and between the people, you know, Romeo, Benvolio, Mercutio. They have love for each other that isn't necessarily what Romeo and Juliet have, but that's important, you know, between Juliet and the nurse. They have such a special relationship. And so I wanted to highlight that. And so in our version, we go ahead and get the deaths over with. So we're not, you know, necessarily encapsulated by that and tuning out by everything else, but we get to enjoy these scenes with the trio, which are some of my favorite scenes, or scenes with Juliet and the nurse. We get to see how their relationship really evolves, or the friar and Romeo, where it's this wonderful mother-son relationship. That's another thing about our version. We do a lot of cross-gender casting.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone who's typically a man in Shakespeare's plays aren't necessarily all men, and vice versa. So that was a really interesting thing to also discover.
I guess we don't really need a spoiler alert for Romeo and Juliet. Everybody kind of knows what happens at the end. But is this, you know, we know Shakespeare borrowed from everybody. He
right.
took his stories from a lot of different people. But so is this framing, this context with hip-hop, doing it backwards, how does that challenge ideas or make mm-hmm. us think differently about the play?
I think that it challenges what we thought Shakespeare was and what we think Shakespeare is, and then also the question I was talking about earlier about who it belongs to. For me, it was seeing Othello at the Globe with Mark Rylance as Iago, Andre Holland as Othello, and Aaron Pierre as Cassio. I was watching that, and I felt so emotionally connected to it. It made me question everything that I thought I knew about classical work. And that's what I wanted to do with this production. I wanted to change the way people thought about Shakespeare, you know, instead of brushing it off or, oh, you know, that's not really for me. That's not the type of thing that, you know, I can really do. This version of the show gets down to the people, the relationships, the characters, and it shows us that it's all of us. You know, we all have a stake in this story. This could be any one of us, and we have the rights to it.
Yeah, so Othello, one of Shakespeare's plays that famously has one person of color,
right.
a man of African descent in it. Wondering what it's like for you. You know, you're a student. You're a junior, which is a big deal for doing a production like this. But you're just meeting Jamil Jude in the green room. What does that mean for you?
I actually was working on a production at True Colors Theater, which he's now the artistic director for, 2 years ago. Kenny Leon directed Holler If You Hear Me, and I was working backstage on that production when Jamil Jude came into the True Colors family. So I actually got a chance to meet him then, and we were actually just in communication about a week ago about Romeo and Juliet. So it was really nice to see him again, and hopefully we'll get together soon to have a chat.
So this story, so well known to so many people, you are bringing a new face to it, many new faces and new ways of looking at it. Booker, how has it changed how you look at the play?
It definitely has made me kind of see it more like, I guess, the relatability factor, you know, how current it is and how the urgency thing, you know, you think about it, everybody is moving on impulse. And especially the way that we do it, since it's nonlinear, you get to see more specifically Romeo and Juliet are moving backwards, but everybody else is moving forward. So, like, you know, you think about everyone's actions, you know, 1 second early, 1 second late, maybe Mercutio wouldn't have been killed, maybe Tybalt wouldn't have been killed, maybe the friar would have got the letter to, you know, Romeo. You know, all these things are because of how urgent people are being in the situations, but also, like, you know, some of these things could have been prevented just if somebody took a second to think about it. And so I guess that's the takeaway for our version. Like, you know, you can be urgent, but, you know, don't let impulse kind of control your fate.
So we have just half a minute left. Alexis, wondering, you know, taking this play, so many film directors, other productions have tried to make it more accessible to people. Is that part of the goal here for you?
It is definitely making it accessible to the people who I see and come in contact with every day. Even in our own department, we don't do a lot of classical work. And I think that's such a shame because there's so much beautiful poetry in the text. And I think that as people of color, you know, we have a natural adaptation to rhythm. And so I think this is something that we definitely need to start doing.
Well, R&J begins this weekend. It's running during Spelman College's Family Weekend. There's more information at our website, gpbnews.org. Alexis Booker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And break a leg.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you watched the Grammys last Sunday, it was not a night of the usual suspects. The show kicked off with Camila Cabello and a few Latin music luminaries for starters, and then came the awards.
And the Grammy goes to Invasion of Privacy, Cardi B.
And the Grammy goes to This Is America, Childish Gambino.
The Grammy goes to Golden Hour, Kacey Musgraves.
The performances and the winners showed a lot more diversity than in the past. For years, critics have noted the Recording Academy, which produces the event, favors white male artists. And those charges really came to a head last year. Some notable artists boycotted the event last weekend. So we're asking entertainment reporter Jewel Wicker whether the Grammys' efforts to diversify really delivered. Hello, Jewel.
Hey, how you doing?
So we just heard from a few winners. What stood out for you?
So I think several moments stood out for me. Obviously, Cardi B winning Best Rap Album was a huge deal. I think she totally deserved it, and I was really excited to see her as the first woman to win as a solo artist because Lauryn Hill won with the Fugees back in the 90s. So that was obviously really historic. Also, Drake, that moment that he had when he won Best Rap Song for God's Plan and kind of said, you don't need a Grammy to be a legitimate artist, and then the mic got cut off, and so that kind of debacle. And then I thought Childish Gambino's wins were obviously really big as well. And then his producer shouting out 21 Savage because we were all looking to see if he would get shouted out or he would get some type of representation at the Grammys. And that was the only one that he got. So,
yeah, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
Let's start with that Childish Gambino. The first time ever a hip hop song won Record of the Year and Song of the Year for This Is America, both by Childish Gambino / Donald Glover. He's from Stone Mountain, Georgia, and he made Grammy history. Let's hear a little bit of the song.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up.
So what does this mean for hip hop?
I mean, I think it's a big historic win, but I think the Grammys still has a long way to go to prove to hip hop and rap artists that diversity is something that is truly important to them and that hip hop is something that's valued, right? When we look at the fact that Outkast is the only hip hop act that's won album of the year, I think the complaint becomes that hip hop artists have to make more mainstream or crossover records in order to be recognized by the Grammys. And so I think there's still a long way to go for the Grammys to prove that they value hip hop as a genre.
And Childish Gambino didn't even attend the awards. He declined an invitation to perform. So first of all, was this absence meant to be a protest?
Well, I mean, I can't speak on his behalf, but I did read, I believe it was Rodney Carmichael from NPR, who said that it would have kind of dulled the message of This Is America had he shown up, right? Mm-hmm. It would have kind of gone against everything that This Is America represented. So I think it probably was purposeful that he didn't show up. Yeah.
Who else chose not to perform?
So Ariana Grande chose not to perform as well. That turned into a huge thing. She wanted to perform Seven Rings and it didn't come together. And so it was kind of a he said, she said between her and producers of you know, were they willing to compromise, and was it on her or was it on them? So she didn't show up, but she won her first awards. So I think, you know, I can't say that she regretted it, but I do wonder if she wished she would have shown up for that, because I mean, as much criticism as the Grammys get, it probably was a big moment.
Well, Kendrick Lamar also did not perform. Drake did not perform. But as you said, he did show up to accept his award for Best Rap Song. It was cut off during, I'd say, kind of a diss of the Grammys. Here's a little bit of his speech.
This is a business where sometimes, you know, it's up to a bunch of people that might not understand, you know, what a mixed race kid from Canada has to say, or a fly Spanish girl from New York, or anybody else. If there's people who have regular jobs who are coming out in the rain, in the snow, spending their hard-earned money to buy tickets to come to your shows, you don't need this right here. I promise you, you already won. But
next, a special Grammy performance.
So great message. But do you think that was a deliberate move by the Grammys, cutting him off right there?
So they said that he made a natural pause, and so they believed that he was finished, and that's why he cut his mic. And they also said that they gave him an option to go back on stage and to finish his speech, but he said that he declined and said that he was done. I don't know that they did it on purpose, but I think optically it just
looks bad.
It did not look good, especially, like I said, the criticism that they received, especially from hip hop acts. I don't think it looked good, whether or not it was deliberate.
And also with women, Grammys had quite a problem with gender diversity, which really blew up last year. Can you give us a little background on that?
Yeah. So Recording Academy President Neil Portnow made this speech where he said that women needed to step up if they wanted to be win awards or be more nominated. And so last year, only 17 of the 86 awards were given to women. It's a huge jump this year. It was 31 women won awards. So that's kind of the background of going into this year, where all of these women were recognized compared to last year when he made that statement.
Yeah, so they made a big effort to feature women in the show. What do we see for performers that really stood out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we had Brandi Carlile, we had great performers, but I also want to know Alicia Keys was the first woman to host in over a decade. So that was really significant as well. And she brought out Michelle Obama, which was a huge moment. So I think even outside of performances, they made efforts to include women throughout the program.
And they won about half of the major awards.
Yeah.
Kacey Musgraves won Best Album. Cardi B, first solo women to win Best Rap Album, as you mentioned. But I want to get to that other personality that you mentioned, rapper 21 Savage, now free on bond. A story you've been following really closely, his arrest in Atlanta. So for those who don't know the story, can you give us just a little bit of a synopsis?
Yeah, so on Super Bowl Sunday, I think a lot of people in Atlanta and across the country and probably the world were really shocked to find out that 21 Savage had been detained by ICE, and who was saying that he was a UK-born artist and that he had overstayed his visa and was in the country illegally, which is a huge shock to anyone who is a fan of 21 Savage, because he is known so much for being an East Atlanta rapper. So he was detained on Super Bowl Sunday, and there were about 9 days of, I would say, protests from supporters, artists reaching out, Jay-Z helping to get him counsel, and a lot of this outspoken when it comes to artists and supporters. And then yesterday it was announced that he had finally been granted bond, because he had been denied that and didn't even get to attend the Grammys.
Well, after years of some political stuff definitely coming out at the Grammys, there was not really a peep about 21 Savage, you know, detained by ICE, except for by one collaborator. What do you think was going on there?
Yeah, so I went to a protest yesterday outside the Atlanta Immigration Court, and his manager showed up, and he told me that they did ask several artists whether or not, because Post Malone performed a song that he has with 21 Savage, so they had asked several artists to come in and rap his rock star verse kind of in solidarity with him. And they said that the artists did say, like, they were supporting it and they were agreeing to do it, but that it's the Grammys, you can't really put together something last minute, so it just didn't come together.
Now, you, Jewel, spoke with NPR's All Things Considered about this story. Why do you think this story has gained so much national attention?
Oh, I think for several reasons. I mean, I think we're having such a huge conversation nationally about immigration right now, and it puts the focus on Black immigration, which I think is something that we tend to not talk about as much when we talk about immigration issues. It also talks about identity, right? If someone moved somewhere when they were a child in elementary school, do they get to claim that place as their own, right? I mean, he didn't. For all intents and purposes, he doesn't know London. You know, he grew up in East Atlanta. So is he still an East Atlanta rapper? I would say yes. But I think it brought up that conversation. And it, like I said, it just brought to head a lot of the immigration conversations that we're having.
Sounds like the case, he's free on bond, but case far from over?
Oh, it's far from over. Absolutely. You know, he's still facing deportation hearings. And so, you know, there's a lot of issues coming up with an expunged felony case that he had previously, and then also a U visa that's pending for him. So there's a lot of moving parts here, and I think that's going to play into whether or not how this case plays out.
So the felony charge, did we know in the past when he was arrested for the felony charge or charged that he was not a U.S. national?
No, we didn't know. So in 2014, he was arrested for felony drug charges, pled guilty, 12 months of probation, and the case was eventually sealed and expunged. And so his lawyers have been saying he does not have a conviction, and ICE has been saying that he does have a conviction. Spoke to some Atlanta immigration experts and lawyers, and they basically said that, yeah, it's expunged, but for purposes of immigration, that still counts as a conviction.
Well, Jewel Wicker, we'll keep up on this case with you. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Entertainment reporter Jewel Wicker does a lot of things. She's great to follow on Twitter. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, and we will celebrate by talking about love, relationships, and the forces that erode them with Tayari Jones. She's author of An American Marriage, so certainly hope you will join us for that. But before we close today, we're going to get this love fest going with a glimpse, or really sounds, of one facet of modern love, the long-distance relationship.
My name is Nicholas Johnson. I'm 21.
My name is Julian Kreist, and I'm 21 years old.
Me and Lorraine have been together for almost 2 years. We got together in July of 17.
First words I ever said to Serenity were, "Who the F are you?" And so she was just like, "I'm Serenity." I'm like, "Oh, I've heard about you, blah, blah, blah." And so we were talking, and I was really nice to her. And eventually, we just kept talking from there. We've been together nearly 2 years. There was a point where there was a bit of a separation, but she and I, when she and I talked about it, we viewed it as, let's just keep it going, because we never fell out of contact. But yeah, nearly 2 years as of March 24th.
Our differences impacting our relationship. Generally, military guys actually get a bad rep for relationships. Everybody thinks that the military guys are always angry and they like beat on their wives or something crazy like that. And then me being a Black guy on top of that, being in pretty much an all-white neighborhood, like I was getting crazy looks like, is this the guy that she's with? But as people got to know me, being a kind and respectful young man, they had totally different outlooks on that, especially her family. You know, they think she would walk into the door with a white guy named Nick, most likely. So that was pretty crazy. As far as my family goes, I don't think anybody's really had too much of a problem with it at all. I mean, I think that in the same way her family probably would have preferred her to be dating a white guy, I think that in some of my family members' mind, I should be dating a Black girl or married to a Black girl. So, I mean, we've had kind of the same struggles, I guess.
She's in California, literally across the country. We made it work nearly this long because even though she was scared, I know she loves me. And so I kept going.
I think, especially being so young, finding a person that you want to be with and you want to connect with and you want to share your fears and you want to share your goals with is something that we both hadn't found before. And it's just amazing that it had, you know, so happened with two people who are so young and not even believing that something like that was possible to happen at the moment.
Our first year together was rough. It was I'm not going to lie, it was horrible. She could tell you the same thing. There was a lot of mistrust. There was a lot of doubt. There was, you know, are they worth it? Am I worth it? Like, there was just so many questions and just so much happening at once. And it goes back to me being stubborn. It was just this, I'm going to see this through to the end. It can't be this bad. Because she necessarily wasn't a bad person to me. It was just our situations were bad at the time, but we were good to each other. Our first year together was completely never face-to-face, which was also terrifying because, you know, you don't know, even though, yes, we were, you know, video chatting all the time and blah, 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 you know, it's still scary. We never made, you know, I never even hugged the girl. So I visited her in January, and we were terrified. Because there's that thought of like, oh, what if I kiss you and there's nothing? What if all this time it's just been kind of like a hopeful fever dream kind of deal? But luckily, it wasn't. It was a very good moment. And I had stayed in California for a week. When you are away from somebody for so long, and then you get to see them, and they smile that hard, and their eyes like light up, it's an incredible feeling. And with Serenity, I had that feeling. It made everything worth it in the world to me.
She always wants to be close to me. She's always okay with talking. She's always okay with texting. If she goes somewhere, she always invites me out. Even if it's her and the ladies and, you know, their husbands aren't there, she still invite me, you know. And I think that having a person with me that's so about me and so for me is probably the most awesome thing, you know. And not everybody can get that kind of, you know, love and affection from her, but knowing that I have that and, you know, I'm giving it in return is probably the best thing.
I want her to hear that I'm fighting for you. I'm still trying for you, even though sometimes it may not seem like it, I am. And I hope that you never, ever doubt that, and that I'll always keep my promises that I made.
Anything that I could say right here, she should already know that I love her and that I miss her and that I'm ready to start building and becoming what we're supposed to be.
That is recent Army vet Nicholas Johnson reflecting on being away from his partner, Lorraine. And before that, we heard from Julian Kreist talking about going the distance with Serenity on this Valentine's Day Eve. Thanks to them and to GPB's Jade Abdul-Malik, who produced that segment. And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. What does love look like for you? Well, you can let us know on our Facebook group, GPB Radio's On Second Thought. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message. We're at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. Be back tomorrow with more On Second Thought.